and welcome to this week's episode of Not D&D, brought to you by EM World Live. As always, I'm your host, Jessica, and this week we have Daniel joining us to talk about Wandering Blades. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I didn't say your full name, but because some people might recognize it when you say your full name. So I'm going to give you space now to kind of introduce yourself and some of the games people might recognize you from in the TTRPG space.
Oh my God, the thought of people recognizing my name is still strange to me. Yeah, my name's Daniel
really?
Kwan. Yeah, I don't know. I think the idea of people knowing my work is still foreign to me.
Oh, well, I did. You sent me an email and I was like, Is it that same one? And I Googled it and I was like, it is. Okay, yes. Yeah, you can come on the show. But yeah, anyway.
I was at a convention this past weekend and I signed a couple of books, which is still new to me.
Very cool.
Yeah, my name's Daniel Kwan. I'm a Canadian podcaster, game designer, and cultural consultant. I'm the co-host of the Asians Represent podcast on the One Shot Network. And I guess folks might know me for my freelance work. I've written for a lot of different companies. I've done Candlekeep Mysteries for Wizards of the Coast, but this is the Not D&D podcast, so I'll spend more time talking about the other stuff. Or for Simon & Schuster, the Ultimate Micro RPG Guide, Avatar Legends, Dark Archive, and Tian Sha for Paizo. And then, you know, I've done Motherlands and a host of other things. I think I've worked on over 40 tabletop games at this point. And, you know, as a consultant, I've worked for like Dimension 20, Critical Role, Asmodee. And then I guess as an indie designer, I'm most known for my World War One game, Ross Rifles. And I guess now this Wandering Blades thing that I'm doing.
Yes. So we're here to talk about Wandering Blades. So we're going to dig into that and talk about it because it's in development at the moment. So it's an exciting place to talk about, I feel. But one thing about kind of your background, you've done like so many games. I know a lot of people that listen to the podcast are aspiring games designers. They kind of have ideas, but perhaps haven't got published yet. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into it and how you got started and got the opportunities to work on so many great projects?
Yeah, got started in design or got started in tabletop?
whatever makes the most sense, because did it blend together? Or
yeah, they did, actually. It's a really long journey. I got started playing tabletop RPGs when I was 11.
Oh, wow.
So I'm based in Toronto, and there's a museum here called the Royal Ontario Museum. It's the it's the biggest cultural and natural history museum in Canada.
Oh, wow.
And my mother signed my brother and I up for a summer camp there, and that summer camp was called Dungeons and Dragons, and I had no idea what this was. I had no idea what it was. Actually, I tell the story a lot, and I was like, oh, I thought we were gonna like, you know, make fake weapons, and I was gonna get to hit my brother.
Yeah, that was like a lot.
But started playing D&D there, and we basically, the program was like, learn about history and science in the gallery and then play tabletop RPGs in the gallery surrounded by like dinosaurs and like arms and armor and stuff. And
so
I got hooked. I ended up like getting so hooked that, you know, I ended up volunteering and getting a job at the museum and working with that program. And then, you know, went to school and got a degree. And while I was in grad school, I started teaching at the museum and I took over the program. And in doing that program, I got to like meet a lot of cool people, and then I got connected locally with the folks behind a convention here in Toronto called Breakout Con, which actually just happened less than a week before we started recording this. And they asked me to come and talk about like teaching kids how to play games and, you know, how I kind of tied the two together with science and history. And that's how I got my start in the industry. I actually started like meeting people through the local con scene. And my first project was a game called Ross Rifles, which was a World War One game that I wrote with two of my staff at the museum at the time. We started a business.
Oh, nice.
And we designed the game to basically teach World War One. And we had our first playtest on like Remembrance Day here in Canada. And and then my career kind of got started there. People kind of knew me for like, you know, as the educator who played role-playing games. And as I got more opportunities, I started to get, you know, more speaking engagements. People started to ask me to write for them. And then I kind of built up a platform for myself using like our podcast, Asians Represent, to kind of talk about what I was interested in. And here I am.
Amazing.
All thanks to a summer camp when I was 11 years old.
Yeah, that summer camp sounds so cool. Is it still running?
It is. And one of my former staff runs it now.
Perfect. That sounds so cool. What a great introduction to be sitting amongst all the histories, and like that must really bring it to life. That's so cool. I love
I run into my former students all the time.
Oh yeah.
I was at this con and I saw three of my former students still playing RPGs. I ran into one maybe 2 weeks ago who works at a local game store and was like, oh yeah, I'm in university now. And it immediately made me feel old.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, time does pass like that. But you know, really I think pandemic years don't count, so surely we can knock 5 or so years off. So yeah. But what advice would you give to people that are looking to enter the TTRPG space? Like obviously you've shared what your journey was, but do you have any guidance for people that maybe have ideas for games or are passionate about them but you're not sure where to start?
Yeah, like my journey is very, very, there's a lot of luck, a lot of like things falling into place. But in general, the thing that I've learned in this industry is that it is a very small space. Like everybody knows everybody. And reputation is really important. And that's not to say that you need to like suck up to people or anything like that. The thing that I'm saying is that if you're a new designer and you want to, you know, enter the space, don't be afraid to reach out to people. Don't be afraid to kind of be honest and say like, hey, I'm a new designer. I'd love to get 30 minutes of your time. A lot of people when I started, you know, gave me that 30 minutes and it really helped me out. So that's something that I like to offer folks. So, you know, folks typically will reach out and be like, hey, you know, I'm a pro GM and I want to publish my own stuff. Could I like talk to you? And I'll do it. So one tip is to, you know, reach out to folks, be honest that you're new, have that learner's mindset and try to make connections. And try to make genuine connections with folks. The second thing is that like, as a designer, it has never been easier to publish your own stuff, right? With platforms like, you know, DriveThruRPG, you know, itch.io, you can put something together and throw it online and build up a portfolio that way. Before Ross Rifles, we kind of experimented with fun games. Like, you know, we made a one-off D&D thing. We made a game that was literally just designed to look like a zoo brochure, like a map. And it was just a game about being animals at a zoo. We just kind of color printed some stuff and started selling those at cons. But it's never been easier to like publish your own thing on an itch page. It functionally is your website, your online store, and your portfolio. And of course, there are lots of companies that will hire folks who don't have a lot of experience. I don't know if you've looked at the author list and the create. I should say the creator list because it's also artists for the new Tian Sha books that Paizo is publishing. But I'd say more than half of the people who are on that project had made no more than one or two credits to their name on indie stuff. So a lot of big companies actually take a lot of chances and want to work with new creators. And it's all about reaching out. Whether it be on like social media or through things like an email. So a big thing is just like kind of put yourself out there, you know, be positive, make sure that you're like reaching out to people and being honest and genuine and having folks who are going to be advocates for you.
Great. That's some great advice. I love that. Speaking of games available on itch, let's talk about Wandering Blades a little bit. Because obviously that's, available on itch now, you can download the quick start. And I think at the time of recording, you're planning on getting version 2.0 out in April when this is going to be broadcast. So around this time, that'll be available then. The link is on the screen or in the show notes if you're listening to the podcast. But let's talk a bit about Wandering Blades. So what is the pitch? So if people come into this for the first time, what's Wandering Blades about?
Yeah, so Wandering Blades is an old school style TTRPG. But it kind of takes violence and combat a step further. So it's inspired by the Chinese wuxia media genre, and it essentially lets you recreate violent melodrama or really, really gorgeous violence. The pitch was that we really wanted to make a game about hyper lethal combat, but we wanted dynamic cinematic fights that were not only simple to run, but also mechanically reinforced by the game. And so we found that a lot of games within that sort of OSR design space didn't have a heavy focus on sort of stylish combat. And so we wanted to bring that into the sort of community.
I love that. So what sort of inspirations and reference points did you take for the game?
Yeah. So for the game, a lot of the sort of genre inspiration came from like movies for like Hong Kong action cinema from like the 60s, mm-hmm. 70s and 80s. Movies like, you know, Come Drink With Me, the movie by one of my favorite directors, John Woo, Last Hurrah for Chivalry, movies, more contemporary movies like Shadow, Hero, less Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, though. Mm-hmm. And then other forms of media like Chinese comics. There's a comic called Biao Ren, Blades of the Guardians, which is like a super sort of like gritty and violent wuxia comic.
Uh-huh.
There is actually like an animation that you can find on like YouTube for free. Okay. It is incredible. It's gorgeous. And then in terms of like combat, the feel of combat, we really wanted it to feel like you were playing a From Software game, like Sekiro and other games like Ghost of Tsushima. We wanted it to feel deadly. We wanted it to feel like combat, and the results of combat came down to contests of skill rather than luck.
I love that. So how? So let's dig into it. So how? You mentioned the combat being simple yet tactical. So how do we achieve that? What does combat look like in the game?
Yeah, we did a lot. So in terms of combat, essentially, we were not the first people to do this, but we basically approached it with a player first philosophy. So players are always going to go first, unless they don't, in the initiative order. We wanted to use. Basically provide a way to segment the initiative order by dividing it between fast and slow turns. Fast turns, you know, you get one action, slow turns, you get two actions.
Got it,
And anybody who chooses to go fast, players always go first, and they get to determine the order in which they act. That way we wanted to make sure everyone was really engaged at the table and not just kind of sitting there passively and waiting for their turn.
Yeah, for sure.
Combat itself is very deadly. You know, players have hit points, which kind of represents their posture and their basically what protects them from serious harm. A player can die very quick, but in order to make the game more cinematic and dynamic, we added in a mechanic inspired by the source material, the genre source material, and we added in a chi mechanic. And so in our game, chi is essentially the underlying thing that all characters have mastery of, and they could use it to do things like parry, unleash really powerful martial arts techniques that let them bypass a lot of the dangers of combat, let them, you know, take multiple actions, block multiple times. But it's a currency that they have to manage very carefully because it doesn't come back as fast as they like. So they have to kind of think about what you're carrying from one combat encounter to the next. In terms of like combat, in terms of mechanical resolution, it's, you know, D20 plus stat, you roll damage. But it's in the ability for a player to make tactical decisions about blocking, about positioning, that makes it really, really sort of strategic.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's also strategic, not just for what you're doing with your own player, but what the other players are doing. So it sounds like there's like things you can do. It matters like what you're doing with the other team players, like deciding the orders you go in. So is 100%. It fair to say there's a bit of communication amongst how we're approaching this as a group, opposed to just I'm doing my cool thing?
Yes, totally. It could be like, hey, look, I want to unleash this cool thing. I want to hit the boss character, but we've got these like two other like sort of meat shields in the way. So I'll go last. If you two other players could take out these two guards, I'll unleash my main attack and we'll end the fight. Or it's like, hey, we've got this big boss and we're having a hard time dealing damage. Hey, could you two maybe like try to grapple this person to hold them down so I can just stab them in the gut? because we're having a hard time getting through their armor. And that's all kind of reinforced by the mechanics of the game. One thing that I've been doing as I've been designing this game is really making sure that it can replicate the sources of inspiration for us. So as a design exercise, what I've been doing is essentially looking at combat that we want to replicate and seeing second by second, frame by frame, as I'm watching like video gameplay or like a movie or a TV show, seeing if our game system can replicate that.
Okay, right.
And so far it's been like a really wonderful exercise that's kind of helped me really determine like in one sentence, in a couple of words, what we want with combat and our design philosophy with that. And it's like time to violence. So, you know, in sales, you think about like, oh, what's time to value? In our game, from a design perspective, we were thinking about, well, what brings the players to this gorgeous violence faster. And it's things like players sharing initiative, players going first, players being engaged, but also things like removing grid-based combat and having it work around engagement zones.
Okay.
So you could really think about how cool am I looking right now and where am I relative to others?
Okay. Love that. So it takes out some of the crunch in terms of you're not like getting a measuring stick out and be like, that's 5 feet away. It's more just more narrative.
Yeah, it's like you're within like close range of me. Okay, you're within mid range of me. Yeah, things like that. Taking away the barriers to making a fight compelling and to making it narratively have stakes.
I love that. So we've kind of talked about like fast turns and slow turns, and then obviously different characters will have actions and reactions, things they can do. I noticed in the quick start you mentioned morale. So how does that play into combat?
Yeah, so like, you know, morale is not a sort of a new thing that you see. It's in a lot of like old school tabletop RPGs. The idea here is that we don't want combat to always have to be, you have to kill everyone. Right?
Yeah.
That's not how fights end in movies. That's not how fights end in real life. You know, the opposing party will have morale, and you can do things like take out the leader, and you can take out the leader and then force everyone to essentially make a roll that could result in them running or surrendering. You could do things like, hey, take out half of the enemy force and force the other half to really question whether or not they want to be there. They want to continue throwing hands or, you know, clashing steel. And so by introducing like morale into the game, we again kind of allowed players to end fights in a way that was more strategic, right? If this is a hard fight and they're overwhelmed by the enemy force, maybe we focus our attention on their leader. And then that way, if we take out the leader, we don't have to worry about taking out all of these other characters.
Yeah, I love that as an idea. So the quick start guide I read through as well had a lot talking about different characters who are going to be playing in this game. Because like you're saying, if you're doing really, really kind of cool combat like that, really cinematic, the characters we're playing are going to be people that have, you know, they're really good at what they do. They're masters of various techniques and skills. So what was your idea behind character creation? How did you create that?
So we wanted, we don't want this game to be a game that has like a million classes. We want this game to have classes that allow players to essentially embody a lot of the different genre tropes of Wuxia. In the current version of the Quickstart, at the time of recording, there is one class called the Yosha. The Yosha is essentially the Chinese knight errant, the wandering folk hero. And that class is essentially a martial arts or weapons master. You walk around with a box of swords or a box of weapons, and you know you belong to a martial arts school. So anyone who builds a Yosha, and we did this intentionally, we released the quick start with multiple sects or schools so that you could play a game with five other people with the same class and each have a different fighting style.
Okay.
In version two of the quick start, we're going to update some of those sects and then add in another class, which is the outlaw.
Okay.
So the outlaw is less of like your rogue or your bard and more of a character that kind of fits in this social slash combat role. You can build the outlaw as like a black market merchant. You could simply be a character who's really good at getting deals and using coin to get out of situations. Or you can be the kind of outlaw who is versed in the ways of brutality. You're good at torture. You're good at making people afraid of you. Or you can be an assassin. You can be you know, a thief, an acrobat. These are all things that the outlaw can be. And then once we release version two, I'm actually currently in my handy design notebook, I've been working on the third class, which is going to be the detective. The detective is a character trope that you see in a lot of Wuxia. And the detective is going to be on the opposite end of the spectrum from the Yosha, who's a combat class. The detective is going to purely be a role play class. They will have some combat abilities, but they're going to be about deduction, detection, sort of scholarly pursuits. And so with those three core classes, with the outlaw kind of in the middle, we're going to allow players to essentially replicate a lot of their favorite characters that they see from Wuxia.
Amazing. And is the idea for like the story and the setting it's going to be in, ideally you'd have a team of different types of people, or would it lend itself to, you know, players could be any combination that they want? It doesn't really matter if everyone's the same sort of class or...
Yeah, people could be anything that they want. The idea is that you don't need to have one of everything. And if you have five outlaws, there are going to be five different, very different builds for your outlaws. We haven't tied weapons and armor to a particular class. So you could use any weapon and any armor that you want. But there's a lot of what I guess folks will say build variety. So rather than have the class really dictate and focus what the player is supposed to do, we said, this is the media trope that we're trying to replicate. And here are all of the pathways that you can take it. And there are three options so far. We're thinking about maybe a fourth or a fifth class, talking about things like an apothecary, almost like a healer. But Wuxia as a genre is something that is like low magic or like almost no magic. So we're not going to have magic users and things like that.
Yeah.
At most, we might have an exorcist class.
Oh, I'm already intrigued by that. So yeah, looking forward to hearing more about that in the playtest and quick start documents. One of the things I noticed about the characters as well is, whilst obviously there's lots about carry capacity and the different techniques they have and all the things like that, there was a really, it seemed to be an emphasis on the narrative side, which was the melodrama of the situation with like drives, keepsakes, and connections. Could you talk us through where you are with those in the current design?
Yeah, so we wanted, of course, to have a game that was like about violence, right? But we wanted to make sure that violence wasn't something that players were engaging with without any sort of intention.
Yeah.
If you're going to fight somebody, you have to have a reason for fighting them. And we reinforced that because of the lethal nature of the world. Yes, at the start of the game, at the start of the session, you are incredibly powerful. You have all of your resources, all of your chi, all of your hit points and all of that. But, you know, as the adventure kind of plays out, you may go into encounters with folks with fewer resources. And so the decision to fight is very, very much mediated by two things. One, like the resource system that we have in order to keep you feeling dangerous, that like sort of time to violence, and the idea of, you know, using these drives and connections and keepsakes to advance a character.
Yeah.
One of the things I really don't like is the idea of having to fight or kill things to level up. And
so
in version two, we're going to introduce rules for character advancement. And character advancement isn't actually tied to combat. Character advancement is actually tied to five things. Participation. So one, you have to participate. And that's up to you, actually. If participation for a player is, I'm going to just be that strategist in combat and I'm going to kind of respond to other people role-playing, cool. That counts.
Yeah.
If you're the person who's like, listen, I just want to roll my attacks and that's it. And I really want to role play outside of combat, that counts too. So first one's participation. The second one is accomplishing noteworthy things in the world.
Okay, right.
So that could be, you know, helping an entire village. That could be assassinating a corrupt official. The one of the sort of like base things about Wuxia is that the main characters kind of exist outside of the sort of government. They aren't generals, they're not soldiers, they're not lords, and they aren't aristocrats.
Yeah. Right?
So how do you impact the world? And if you are able to actually have an impact on the people you interact with, you get experience for that. Same things with drives. Every character has like a drive that kind of dictates their, not only their backstory, but how they may interact with others. So we want to make sure that XP is rewarded by taking meaningful action related to your drive. Same thing with your connections, right? If you're playing solo, you might have an NPC connection. If you're playing with a group, you're going to have another player connection. And so we want to make sure that players are actually interacting with each other outside of combat and coordinating outside of combat and actually thinking about how their actions are impacting others. And then, of course, lastly, it's the fifth thing is failure. We want to make sure that we don't want to make people fail, but we want to reinforce the fact that failure leads to growth.
Yeah, I love
that. And so, you know, with regards to the role play, we're encouraging that through, like I said, making sure that combat is meaningful and that the decision to enter combat is always made by the players. And two, that character advancement is tied to the impact you have on the world and your connections with other players and, you know, the decision-making you undertake at a narrative level.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the subject of failure, you mentioned that it's like lethal melodrama. So I guess that means if you're going to a fight, your character could die.
Yes.
And this isn't D&D, so there's not like resurrection scrolls and stuff like that. So it's
over.
It's serious and it's meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why, again, like for us, I actually have like a reminder in my notebook.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I've been doing is I used to do a lot of my work digitally, and now I kind of am sort of like a hybrid, I guess.
Yeah.
But I wrote a note for myself and I said, every battle must be compelling and have stakes. The PCs have to be enabled to press the advantage. They have to be enabled to capture momentum. And in order to confront the danger and drama of the world, they must be able to use both their martial skill and cunning. And so that's where the lethality comes into play. If the players are like, okay, we're injured. Fighting shouldn't be a thing we do right now. We're until we get to the next town and we can rest and get supplies. Yeah. Let's try to avoid combat or talk our way out of things.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. How would you recommend a GM encourage that someone running the game, encourage the players to do that? Cause we all have experienced a Leroy Jenkins style player, and obviously that wouldn't really match the tone of this. Mm-hmm. So do you have any guidance for people running games that want to, you know, kind of encourage that style of play?
Yeah. Yeah. Two perspectives. One, as a designer, you know, I can do my best to tell people or showcase how we want the game to be played.
Sure.
But ultimately, this is a role-playing game, right? People can do what they want. And, you know, if you have a group, if your group has somebody who's, and you're playing a game with high stakes, right? And very, like, sort of, like, real in-game consequences, like death, you know, we're often going to have guidance about, like, hey, consider who you're running, you know, the game for. But also, be really upfront about the fact that this game is lethal. This game does involve some heavy decision-making. And if you're playing with a group, you really have to consider, you know, the well-being of the other players, not the characters, but players at your table.
Okay,
And so we reinforce that through, again, the resource system that kind of keeps you alive. Yeah, if you have a Leroy Jenkins character who runs in the battle, well, I guess we're using up our resources. And at the end of that, we're probably going to have a conversation in character about maybe trying to avoid fights because now we're all messed up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So we try to reinforce it sort of like through the mechanics and through, you know, how we kind of illustrate how the game is played. One thing we're going to really rely heavily on is this is inspired by Japanese tabletop role-playing games is the media genre of the replay. So in Japan, actual plays aren't very popular, but replays, which are essentially written actual plays, are extremely popular. And so a good chunk of our book is going to be dedicated to replays. So folks can actually read out how the game is played from the perspective of like, Daniel says this, and then, oh, I'd like to do that. To kind of illustrate how the mechanics work and how the conversation at the table happens.
Okay, cool. So that'd be some nice guidance to see, kind of demonstrate how it works. That's really interesting that actual plays aren't huge in Japan, because I know tabletop RPGs that are massive over there. It's a huge market, but that's interesting that replays are bigger than actual plays. Like,
oh, they're huge. Every single, like I've got an English translation of an RPG next to me, and I think about a third of it. There's actually a section here. Let me find it. I just scrolled by it. This is the Goblin Slayer tabletop RPG. It's based on the anime, light novel, manga. But there's actually a section here on good communication at the table.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they cover things like that. And then as you go through different sections, there are actual like short replays. Another game that's from Japan that's actually made its way over with a proper English localization is called Shinobigami. And about a third of that game is a replay.
All right. I love that. So yeah. That's going to be big in this edition as well. So perfect. Do you have any plans for actual plays as well? I know obviously replay is going to be an important thing, but is that
Yeah, we're definitely going to do that. I mean, it's a big part of marketing. Luckily, you know, have a platform like Asians Represent that I can naturally kind of do this on. So yeah, we're going to be doing a big series. I have been working on it for a while. I actually started planning it before I even started doing Wandering Blades.
Oh, great.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And thinking about, obviously this is, like you say, it's really a love letter to a lot of where it comes from, the resources in Japan and looking at those. I know there are some players that if they're not from that culture, you know, or ethnicity, they're always a little bit nervous about playing games like this sometimes. They're like, how do I play this and approach it in a way that is respectful and I'm not going to be, you know, causing any issues for anybody?
Yeah. So how are we doing that? So one of the things that we're doing is one of the people who's going to be working on the project is a professional translator who works in the video games industry.
Okay.
And he's actually going to be writing an entire section on naming conventions. So how to have a Chinese name, how to basically like construct a name. We're also going to have tables for things like, you know, genre trope names that aren't necessarily like Chinese. So we're going to have guidance like that. We're also going to write a section on, you know, the entire genre, what to expect of Wuxia, what are the sort of genre hallmarks, but also how to role play as an Asian character, how to do it respectfully.
Perfect. That's great. Because I always know whenever there's, I know that always question always crops up. So it's great to just let people know, hey, no, this game is for you. Come get involved. It's okay. Sometimes people need.
Yeah. A lot of people are afraid of offending others and we want to make sure that they don't feel that way. We actually did a play test over the weekend at Breakout Con. And one guy's like, oh, like I'm nervous about having like a Chinese sort of name for my character. And my co-designer and I, we were like, that's fine. You don't have to. He's like, okay, cool. I'm Clint. And we're just like, cool. You're Clint. That's it. That's fine.
Fair enough. Yeah, I love that. And so talking about the setting a bit more, as you say, is it going to be based in historical China or is it going to be your own setting or what's the setting going to be?
Yeah, so the idea with Wandering Blades is that you could certainly use it. Like core part of the theme is like hackability. We want you to take this and use it in your other games. Like if you like the whole thing, play Wandering Blades. I have a friend who's like, I really like your dual wielding rules, Daniel. I'm using it in this other OSR game. I'm like, cool, go for it. Nice. That's what we want. We are going to ship it with a setting that I wrote. It's called The Land of Blades. It is inspired by historical China, specifically the Warring States period. I wanted to avoid a lot of historical like anachronisms. I didn't want to make broad sweeping sort of generalizations of what ancient China looked like. So I picked a very specific part of Chinese history called the Warring States. And this was hundreds and hundreds of years ago when China was divided into all of these essentially small kingdoms that were at war with each other. And one of these kingdoms, very interestingly, is called Yue. And it was kind of centered around where I actually did my doctoral research. Funny coincidence. But Yue is one of the only states or periods of Chinese sort of like rulership where they actually named swords.
Oh, wow.
So we think about this from like you know, other fantasy RPGs where like the process of naming swords is just like so automatic to people.
Yeah.
But in China, there aren't a lot of like named swords. And the Yue state, it was kind of renowned for like the quality of the metalworking. They were the only people and one of the very, I should say the very few people who had a cultural practice of naming their swords.
Nice.
And if folks are curious, there's actually a really famous one from this time period called the Sword of Goujian. Sword of and then Goujian. And Goujian was one of the last kings of the Yue state. And when they discovered his sword, it's made of bronze, but when they removed it from the scabbard, it was still sharp and untarnished.
Oh, wow.
And so I really was attracted to this one very specific time period in Chinese history that was all about swords. And so I kind of based my culture in the Land of Blades around it. So it's a, you know, the Land of Blades is basically a region where the people are really hardworking, honest, and the kingdom, the dynasty right now called the Yue dynasty is kind of a callback to this. was basically forged from like centuries of bloody conflict, where the best swordsman essentially prevailed. And so the entire like setting is all about people who revere swords.
Love that. And I guess that will bleed through into the actual equipment. The actual weapons will have names in the book, I'm guessing, then. And that's going to be, will people get to name their own weapons? Is that?
Yeah, people totally can. Like one of the classes, the Yosha, is all about their signature weapon, and they're supposed to name it and everything like that. Another thing from a design perspective, in choosing the UA state was that there is actually very little scholarship on it.
Okay.
Next to no scholarship on it. So for me, it actually gave me a lot of freedom to pull what I wanted and expand on what I found interesting without really having to worry, like the sort of the academic in me being like, oh, this isn't accurate. Well, we don't really know much, so I'm just going to do my own thing.
Yeah, fair enough. That's why I thought I'd ask, because I know you have that, you know, background with history. So I was like, is it going to be historical or is it going to be inspired by? So it sounds like inspired by, like you said, specific part, but gives you space to do your own thing with it. And I guess that's nice for people playing as well, because if somebody's playing the game and they don't know that specific part of history too well, they can be like, well, it's its own setting, so this will be this in
it must be all right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ship it with a setting. I was actually working on the setting as a part of an Asians Represent Actual play that I was planning. And Wandering Blades was actually born out of this whole OGL debacle last year.
That thing
you might have heard about it.
once or twice it's come up.
I had been working on the setting for a really long time. Originally it was far more fantastical, and now I've kind of been toning it back.
Love that. So if so at the moment it's in development. I know you're speaking about kind of publishing and when that will be. That will come later. But if people are interested, what's the best way they can get involved and support Wandering Blades right now at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, if folks want to try it out, they can. It's pay what you want right now on my Itch store. So they can download it there. If they want to see like up-to-date stuff, get early access, peek behind the sort of design notebook, I've been working on this on Patreon. So I release everything ahead of time on Patreon. So just patreon.com/DanielHKwan. For $3 a month, you basically get all of the early updates on Wandering Blades. I solicit feedback from there. And I also do like a monthly video where I actually walk through all of the wacky design choices I make in my notebook and talk about how they're implemented in the game. So if you're curious about like the process of designing a game, support me there. If you can't and you don't have the means, you can always download it for free on Itch. Even word of mouth is super appreciated.
Perfect. Okay, great. And all the links are up in the stream, in the comments, or in the show notes for those things there. Daniel, thanks so much for coming on and talking about Wandering Blades and sharing some of your design philosophy ideas with us. We're coming up to the end of the time, so is there any kind of anything you didn't get the chance to share about the game, or any kind of closing words you want to say about Wandering Blades?
Nothing about Wandering Blades other than, you know, I'm just super excited to be working on it. I do a lot of freelance, and I've been pulling back on the freelance that I've been doing to work on this, and it's been really refreshing for me. It's like, it's been this nice exercise in like ownership over my own work. Yeah. But other than that, no, I'm just super grateful to, you know, be on the show and to have the platform to talk about it. So yeah,
absolutely, yeah, anytime. It'd be great to have you back on when maybe we've got a crowdfunder or a launch date.
Totally.
Or
I'll definitely email you about it.
Yeah. sounds good. So I do have one final question for you that I ask everyone, which is, do you have any tabletop RPG recommendations? So any games you've played that you like, or anyone that you want to shout out? And the only two rules to this question is it can't be a game that you've worked on, and it can't be D&D, of course.
100%. Yeah. I've been thinking about which game I want to shout out. There were like two. I mentioned Goblin Slayer, which is a derivative of a game called Sword World. Sword World is the most popular fantasy tabletop RPG in Japan. But the game I actually want to shout out is a game that I would be surprised if the audience knew. It's a game called Gloria, The Verdant Way. So it's a Japanese indie game. And it's only a silver bestseller on DriveThruRPG. Gloria is really interesting because you actually play as a sort of plant-infused wizard. You are a spellcaster who has a symbiotic relationship with a plant inside of your body. And you travel through these sort of mystical woods helping people. And one of the neat mechanics behind the game is this idea of drawing ley lines. So you actually have a grid on your character sheet, and you have a, you literally create geometric shapes on it and color them in when you take damage, or color them in to cast spells. So I actually think it's like mechanically really, really interesting.
It does sound because interesting.
You're literally drawing out your spells.
Yeah. That sounds very cool. I like the sound of that. Might have to check that out. I certainly didn't know about it. But because you said, I'll be surprised if people know, there'll be people in chat now going, well, I've heard of it. And,
if you've heard of it, please spread the word. I think this game is super neat. I also just think, as like a fan of tabletop RPGs, and if you know, you want to be a designer, it is so important to try other games.
Yes.
Even if they're like thematically not what you're designing, see if there's something mechanically interesting, or just putting yourself outside of your own comfort zone is a really good exercise in growing as a, you know, as a fan or as a creator.
Absolutely. I love it. And even if you're not looking to create, I think it makes you a better person that runs games if you play lots of different ones, because there's always little bits of different systems that you can take to other things and just maybe tweak things for yourself. Even if you're not creating and publishing, if you're just playing and running games, I think that's really great as well. So,
yeah, totally. I mean, imagine if one of your players was like, oh, man, it would be really wonderful if I could draw something out to cast a spell. Boom. Floria right there.
Floria, done. Well, I'm going to check that out because I love that recommendation. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. And thanks so much for sharing Wandering Blades. I'm really excited to see how it develops and changes over time. So I'll be downloading the new quick start when it comes out in April for sure.
I'll send it to you ahead of time.
Oh, perfect. How exciting. That's great, Daniel. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I think that's all the time we have for this week. So I'll say goodbye. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.